The book of Ruth. Well, if you've got it open in front of you, you'll see that according to verse 1, the story of Ruth is set in the days when the judges ruled. In other words, dark days. Do you remember how the Lord had saved his people from Egypt and they had, after 40 years, entered the promised land? And for a time, after they'd settled down, it says that there was peace in the land. But not for very long. The Moabites terrorized the people of God for over 18 years. And then came the Canaanites and the Midianites and the Philistines, and the periods of rest in the land grew shorter and shorter as things just fell apart. And the last few chapters of the book of Judges make desperately sad reading. God's people had started to fight one another. There was idolatry and the sort of gory, barbaric stuff that makes us think, Old Testament, whoa. It seems weird, bizarre, and irrelevant to the 21st century. But it turns out that their world is actually just the same as ours, essentially because their problem is just the same as ours. And in the very last verse of the book of Judges, we get it summarized in one simple sentence. In those days, Israel had no king. Everybody did just as they saw fit. Isn't that our world today? When everyone does as they see fit, then people get shot or stabbed or have acid thrown in their face. Elections get rigged. People get knifed for their mobile phones. And even God's people start falling out with one another. It's a mess. And at the start of Ruth, we read that there is a famine in a place called Bethlehem. And it might well have been crop failure, but it probably would have been made worse by the fact that there wasn't a fair distribution system, simply because it was each man for themselves. And the question it raised for them is exactly the question it raises for us. Where is God in the midst of all of this? Where is God? Bethlehem means house of bread. Famine in the house of bread? What is going on? Has God just given his people over to this wickedness and then just walked away? What is going on? What about his promises? What about way back in Exodus chapter 33, when he first saved his people and he said, "My presence will go with you, and I will give you rest." But here they are, up to their necks in unrest. So what's happened? Has God just abandoned them? And against the backdrop of the dark days of the book of Judges, the biblical camera kind of zooms in on one family, a man whom, you see in verse 1, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in Moab, where there was food. Fair enough, we might think. You've got to feed your family. But in later generations, the story of Ruth was read out every year at the Feast of Pentecost. That was when God's people gave thanks for the harvest. They gave thanks for the way he had given them this promised land. And you can maybe imagine in your mind's eye that later generations of Israelites listening to this story might be thinking, they went to Moab? See, the writer bangs that drum quite noticeably. The end of verse 1, in the country of Moab. The end of verse 2, they went to Moab and lived there. Verse 4, they married Moabite women. Verse 6, when she heard in Moab. You see, the Moabites had spent 18 years attacking God's people. And what was this man Elimelech doing? Leaving God's people, leaving the land God had given them, and going to Moab for refuge. The people there would throw bricks through his window. His children would be taunted in the playground. I mean, he's taking a big risk. And in the mind of the Bible writers, the greatest risk would have been spiritual. Yes, in Moab they may well have found bread. But where were they going to find fellowship and teaching and encouragement in the ways of God? They may well have found in Moab a bigger house with a nice garden. But they would never have found a good youth group for their children. And this man's name was Elimelech, which means my God is king. And I suspect that Israelites listening to the story in later generations would have been thinking, doesn't he believe his own name? He should have stayed in the land. Surely he should have trusted God to keep his promises and to bless them. Others stuck it out. But Elimelech and his family, it says, were Ephrathites from Bethlehem. That is a bit like saying they were the Fotheringham Smythes from Buckinghamshire. In other words, they were a well-to-do family with the means to go. And to a point, we might have sympathy with him, because from where Elimelech was sitting, it doesn't look as if God is king. It looks like a mess. And if God isn't going to see us through this, we've got to hatch our own plans. So he turns away from the land, away from his people, and away from God. It is a recurring temptation. Perhaps you're in some personal or domestic situation, and it is very hard. It seems like a painful mess. And you're thinking, it doesn't look as if God is king. How can he let this happen? And there will be this huge temptation to hatch your own plan. To think, I just need to get out of this situation. And Elimelech thought that was the solution. They went to Moab, full of hope. Everything's going to be fine now. And in Moab, tragedy. You see verse 3. Now, Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. And her two sons. And she was left with her two daughters-in-law, both Moabite women. Think of the pain that lies behind those verses. It is hard enough to bury your husband, but to bury your children. They went away to escape death, but death has caught up with them. It left Naomi all alone, even more alone than she would have been back in Bethlehem, because she's now living in a strange land. And the daughters-in-law who'd been caring for her, well, they would likely remarry, and then what would become of her? Now, there is no sense in which this is presented to us as punishment or anything like that. But the point is, whatever happens to us, walking away from God and his people is never the answer. But then Naomi hears news from home. There is food in Bethlehem now. This is 10 years down the line from when they moved there. So after that long period of time in a strange land, Naomi makes plans to return home. And her daughters-in-law want to go with her. And what she says to them is very moving. In verse 8 she says, "Go back, each of you. May the Lord show kindness to you as you've shown to your dead and to me. And may the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." And you can almost sense the tension between what Naomi knows in her head and what she feels in her heart. In her head, she knows that God does keep his promises, that he is kind, that he does give rest. But do you think that's what she feels? Probably it didn't feel as if the Lord had shown her much kindness or given her much rest. Do you perhaps recognize that sort of tension between what you know in your head and what you feel in your heart? And verse 10 is extraordinary, isn't it? She kisses them, they wept, and they said to her, "We'll go back with you to your people." Here's this foreign woman with a foreign God who doesn't seem to have been much help. A life shot through with pain and suffering. And you'd think they'd be glad to see the back of her. But no, they want to go with her. And she tries to dissuade them. She says in verse 12, "Return home, my daughters. I'm too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they'd grown up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it's more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has gone out against me." She's saying it's not just that you're Moabites and that they won't take to you in my country. But you see, in my culture, the widow has to marry the brother of her husband. And there's going to be no more brothers for you to marry. So stay here. Stay put. And Orpah stays. Fair enough. But Ruth clings to Naomi and says just about one of the most beautiful things that anyone ever said. In verse 16. Don't urge me to leave you or turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay, and your people will be my people, and your God, my God. And where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me. You realize that by going with Naomi, Ruth was opting for a life of exile, a life of poverty, a life of prejudice, a life of celibacy and loneliness. Why? Why does Ruth commit herself to Naomi like that? It's because she has committed herself to Naomi's God. The language which she's using is the language the Lord used when he promised the people of Israel that my presence will go with you. And Ruth echoes those same sort of sentiments. She's saying, I've seen what your God is like. I've seen that he is the God who is totally committed to his people and who sticks with them through thick and thin. I've seen that in all the mess, he is the one worth clinging to. So I'm coming with you. It's intriguing, isn't it? How on earth did Ruth come to see this about the Lord? Because Naomi is not at this moment standing in front of a packed auditorium with sort of trembly music playing in the background saying, well, ever since I became a Christian, my life has been wonderful and I've been healed of back pain and I got promoted and I met this wonderful man and we got married. No, she's living in a chaotic mess. It doesn't seem like a very good advert for God. One of the things that Richard Dawkins keeps saying in his attacks on Christianity is, what about the problem of pain? Well, the Bible never ducks the problem of pain. And here again, we face it full on. But we mustn't pretend that we have an easy answer to the problem. In either the superficial idea on the one hand that God is responsible for all our pain and suffering in order to discipline and punish us, or on the other extreme, that God will always heal us if we just demonstrate enough faith. It's not that simple. But it strikes me that pain is a far bigger problem for the atheist than it is for the Christian. The atheist believes that what is, just is. We are just DNA propagating ourselves blindly. There is no moral ought or should. Nothing can actually mean anything. And yet, in the face of pain, we all cry. And it seems to me that the atheist can't make sense of those tears. Because when you cry, you're saying things matter. People matter. Something's gone wrong. It ought not to be like this. In other words, tears only make sense if the Bible is as it says it is. The Bible says it matters because God made it. It hurts because something has gone wrong. Rather than listen to God, we've done what is right in our own eyes. So our tears don't undermine the truth of the Bible. Our tears only make sense if the Bible is true. But it seems to me often in church life, we're kind of embarrassed about the tears in our lives. We think we've got to present a sort of scrubbed up image to the world, as though the way to honour God is to pretend we are all shiny, happy, successful people. And so you get churches, you know, where you ask people how they are and they say, fine, fine, living in victory. Because we fear that if we are struggling with illness or bereavement, or we're wrestling with doubt, or we're finding it hard to cope or to trust God, we fear that it will make us sound unspiritual. And we fear most of all that it will put people off God in some way. And so we cover it up. Stiff upper lip. I'm fine. And so our friends think that church is where you have to pretend. It turns out church is the one place in all the world where you can be real. And the strange thing is that time and again, when we're honest about our weaknesses and our struggles, and the questions we've got, that's when our friends and family start to see that our God is not just a philosophy that we pay lip service to, but that he is real. He's someone we know, someone we wrestle things through with. He's someone to cry out to, as the psalm writers did. What did Paul say in the New Testament? He says, but we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. Jars of clay were the ancient equivalent of our much maligned plastic bag. Not very impressive and easily ripped. But through her weakness, through her warts and all honesty, this plastic bag, Naomi, pointed Ruth to God. And by the end of chapter 1, there doesn't appear to be any hope of a happy ending to this little story. But the end of verse 22, there is a little clue that the next chapter is going to be worth tuning in for. She left in famine. She came back, verse 22, arriving back in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. Things are on the up. So what are we to make of all this? Well, the hero of any book of the Bible is always God. And so the first question to always ask is this: what does God show us about himself here? And one of the things we see in the book of Ruth is that God is king. He is in control and he has not abandoned his people. He loves them and he is working out his purposes and he's keeping his promises to them. Naomi doesn't understand what has happened to her, but she never doubts God's overruling hand in it all. And thankfully, we know more than Naomi, because we're going to take a little sneak preview now of how the book ends. Warning, spoiler alert. Okay? Do you remember how the book starts in the days when the judges ruled and there was no king? And so there was chaos. And through this ordinary family, this foreign woman, Ruth, God was working out his purposes. Ruth ended up marrying a bloke called Boaz. And they have a son called Obed, and he was the father of Jesse. And Jesse was the father of David. David, the great king in the Old Testament. And so God works out his plan. Chaos because there was no king. And then through this Moabite woman, he provides the king his people needed. Not particularly by way of flashes of divine intervention and miracles. Just through everyday events, the sovereignty of God is at work, bringing about this extraordinary plan. And folks, it didn't stop with David. If you flick on to Matthew chapter 1, there are four women who are mentioned in the genealogy of Jesus at the start of Matthew's Gospel. Rahab, prostitute. Uriah's wife, Bathsheba. The Virgin Mary. And then, tucked into verse 5 of Matthew chapter 1. Do you see? Ruth, the Moabite woman. They are all very unlikely women. Three of them are not even Jewish. But they are all woven into the plan God was working out. The plan to provide Jesus, the king, great David's greater son. The king our world desperately needs. So do you see how it goes? We started in the days of the judges when the situation was a mess because there was no king and everybody did their own thing. And do you see now where the story of Ruth is heading? It's woven into a plan that will lead to the king who will one day unscramble all of this world's mess and bring rest. And so the book of Ruth says that God is totally in control. Through all the things he is working out, his purposes. You know, some people have the deistic view of God, that when confronted with the reality of suffering, there is nothing that he can do about it. If that is the case, what hope is there for the future? It means things are just spinning out of control. But the death of Jesus Christ on the cross was not things spinning out of control. It was in God's plan and purpose from before the beginning of time. And the book of Ruth is full of people making choices, taking initiatives. And yet through it all, God is working out his purposes. The book is a kind of worked example of that famous thing that Paul said in Romans chapter 8, when he said, we know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him. And in the book of Ruth, it highlights the fact that we often don't know why God is allowing us to go through hard times. But it assures us that there is nothing in your life that is just spinning out of control. Through all things, even unwise choices and devastating bereavements, God is still working out his purposes. A pastor had to preach one day in a mining village where there'd been a serious underground disaster and many men had lost their lives. And he really struggled to know what to say to help the hearts of the families of those who were just crushed by such sorrow. And as he opened his Bible, there fluttered from it a bookmark on which a text had been embroidered by his young daughter. And this bookmark fell face downwards. And it was then that he felt God told him what to say. He held up the back of this bookmark to the congregation so that all that they could see would be a tangled mess of wool. And he explained that represented how they felt about this mining accident. No sense, no meaning, no purpose in it. But then he turned the bookmark round and in clear, strong letters, they could read the words, God is love. And there will most probably come a time in your life, if it hasn't happened already, when all that you can see is the tangle, the confusion, and the mess, without any seeming order or pattern. But God is at work on the other side of the tapestry. He is weaving something which, when one day we see it whole in its entirety, it will convince us that all along his great love has been at work, seeking to turn the tragedies and the senseless events of this life into something meaningful and purposeful. Is God king? You may not feel like it in the midst of all the chaotic circumstances in life. But the book of Ruth says to us, look at the other side of the tapestry and recognize that his good plan is being worked out. In 2017, whatever happens to you, cling on to God and his people, whatever it may cost. In 2018, which is only just over 2 months away, there will be things inevitably for some of us which we find hard to cope with, hard to make sense of. When that happens, cling on to God and his people, whatever it may cost. Today may make no sense to us, But God is in control and working out his plan. There will be light at the end of the tunnel, and he will wipe our tears dry, and we will know that he is king. Let's bow our heads and pray. Father God, thank you that you are the same yesterday, today, and forever. And that you are working your purposes out as year succeeds to year. Help us to trust you when all we can see is the confusion and the tangle and the mess. And know that our God reigns and that you are in control. And your love is unending. Amen.